Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So it seems we're inevitably waving off our old heroes. And one of the most recent ones was the man we called Commander Cody, really. But he wasn't actually Commander Cody, was he?
George Frayne? Was he called George
Frayne? Frayne. Yes, right. He just became known as Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen.
I used to love them. Explain
them for the benefit of younger listeners.
Well, they were, there was a kind of vogue, wasn't there, for kind of country-flavoured rock acts like Poco and the Eagles and Asleep at the Wheel and stuff.
And
like
Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks.
Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks, exactly.
And he
carved out a niche that wasn't really like anybody else. It's kind of rockabilly, Western swing and jump blues and jazz and kind of and boogie woogie. He's a boogie piano player, and also terribly funny. And it's just one of those groups that there is absolutely no equivalent of in this country at all. There's nobody like him. He was kind of inspired by the old Western swing pioneer Bob Wills, and they had a wonderful. And they got the name, didn't they, from a series of cheap sci-fi films in the 1940s. Was a sort of Flash Gordon type character called Commander Cody, and the last of these films was called The Lost Planet Airmen. So they thought that'd be a great name for the band. So they started the band, at which point all the audience kind of thought there must be a Commander Cody. They assumed one of them was Commander Cody. So he then had to kind of adopt the personality of Commander Cody and become that person. And he was just fantastic. I love the album Country Casanova. Remember that?
Yeah.
Where he's wearing a fabulous kind of rhinestone encrusted kind of cowboy shirt and leaning against a gorgeous old car, lent him by Jim Marshall, in fact, who's the photographer. And all these brilliant people in the band. Bill Kirchen, beautiful, fantastic guitar player. Buffalo Bruce Barlow. And they did all those old show tunes. Do you remember Honeysuckle, My Honeysuckle, Honey and Me? And My Window Faces the South. And the great masterpiece was a song, was an old novelty hit from the 40s called Smoke, Smoke, Smoke That Cigarette. Do you remember that? It was just so funny. It was a brilliant idea. But at the time when the most heinous thing you could do as regards smoking was to inconvenience other non-smokers, not to threaten their health or your own or anything like that. It's all about poker games and petting parties being ruined by the fact that they all put on hold because somebody has to smoke. Do you remember the chorus of that?
Go on.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you puff yourself to death, tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you would hate to make him wait, but you have got to have just one less cigarette. It was so brilliant. We used to play that over and over again, me and my father. We used to love him. It was so great.
So we were talking about smoking, weren't we, again, in the context of The Good Commander and also the Labour Party conference.
Oh, yeah, well, we saw that. I think I sent you a picture of Angela Rayner. She was on the cover of The Times. And what was shocking to them was not anything that she might have said about the Tory party or Boris Johnson, but the fact she was having a gasper. In a break, she'd gone out and fired up a gasper. And actually, I was quite amazed because I was thinking, and you were too, when was the last time you saw a well-known person fire up, unless they're obviously Nigel Farage and they're doing it as a piece of kind of image mongering and self-positioning, but when would you have last seen a famous person publicly smoking?
It is now something that when you glimpse it in any context other than a load of people huddling outside a pub or a cafe or whatever, it is now something that strikes you as contemporary word alert, transgressive.
Yes, it is.
It's like you've only done that deliberately to irritate everybody else in society, haven't you? Because it's now just so rare to see it. You know, I saw somebody do this on an open air London Transport tube platform, but it was in the open air. I saw somebody with a kind of a vaping device, whatever, and that kind of shocked me. And I had to check whether you're allowed to do that on open air platforms, London Underground, and you're not.
Are you
not
really?
Supposed to, no, you're not supposed to.
Then anybody who does do that, if you go out and challenge them, they're waiting to be challenged. Because they're the kind of people who've got some aggressive response prepared.
Our old mate Tom Maloney used to say this years ago when smoking was first banned on the tubes, and you used to get some people who defied it, didn't you?
Yeah.
And he said anybody who smokes on a tube is looking for a fight.
Yeah. Do not have a word with them.
That's the only reason they've done it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just amazing. And I was thinking about, you know, my kind of personal history of smoking. And yeah, we've all done it. We've all had our years smoking. I was a very devoted smoker for, you know,
me too.
15 years old, probably longer than that. And
that moment when you left the house and you patted both pockets to make sure you had over 20 cigarettes.
Oh, yes, because 120 was not enough.
You know? I know.
That's the thing that strikes you when you think back on it. It's not the fact that you did it. It's the scale upon which you did it is absolutely remarkable. And the amount of money you spent on it and the things you were prepared to sacrifice for it. It's just absolutely remarkable. And, you know, I remember growing up that you kind of had to have a reason not to smoke.
Yeah.
You know, my mother, who didn't smoke, would have one at Christmas. Because it would be...
Just to be sociable.
Just to be sociable.
I know.
It's like you're, you know, teetotal anti.
My dad made himself smoke a pipe because he thought that's what you did. He didn't enjoy it at all, but he went out dutifully, bought the tobacco, spent ages. That whole wonderful ceremony of scraping out the bowl of the pipe and tapping down the tobacco. I know. Fettling. There's a great cartoon I can remember, and there was a brilliant cartoon in the New Yorker, which I can remember, a 3-frame cartoon about your dependence on cigarettes. The first frame was a wife and a husband looking out the window. And they're going, God, who'd go out in this weather? And the next thing, the guy goes, God, we're out of cigarettes. And then the third frame is him kind of, you know, his umbrella blown inside out, walking through horizontal rain to get to, I don't know, gas station or something to buy some. That's how desperate we were.
See that, Mark? What am I holding up?
Oh, is that your dad's pipe?
That's my dad's pipe. No, my dad died, you know, we're getting on for 40 years ago. And you know, but I kept this part. I could smell the tobacco.
Oh, lovely.
That's absolutely amazing it how is. That lingers. That
incredible. You know, I'm nostalgic about
that time, you know. But of course, rock stars and smoking, you know, in the 60s and 70s, they just all did it.
Compulsory.
It was compulsory. Because they spent a lot of time hanging around and also kind of looked cool, didn't it? And I do think the most ridiculous, the wildest shores of cigarette addiction always strikes me whenever I see an old bit of film from the 60s or the 70s where some band are, you know, about to start jamming or rehearsing or whatever. And somebody will start by lighting a cigarette, one of the musicians, taking a drag, and then placing it among the machine heads at the end of the guitar, and then proceeding to play while smoke just drifts into their eyes all the way through, just which must be staggeringly irritating.
Well, all the great jazz photos of the 1950s were characterized, weren't they, by smoke and wreaths of smoke around people. There's a bit in Scorsese's movie, Shine a Light, which I think was made in 2006, wasn't it, at the Beacon Theatre, where Keith Richards kind of lights up a fag and then kind of flicks it up, a light fag. Of course, at that stage, you weren't allowed to smoke indoors, so this was considered to be outrageously rebellious. But actually, you don't see, and there was a famous moment where somebody, an American poster campaign, were promoting Abbey Road in 2003, and they erased the cigarette from Paul McCartney's right hand. And he was very upset about it. He said, nobody asked me. This is ridiculous. You can't do that. Fair enough.
I wonder if, interesting, I wonder if Peter Jackson has had to do anything about this during Let It Be, during his massive, reassembly of all that footage.
Well, you could remove some of them smoke. Yeah, they smoked all the time. I don't think you would you? You couldn't.
Did they all smoke all the time?
Yeah, all four of them.
Really? Good grief. Yeah. That's extraordinary. So who is, you know, David Hockney is the famous, you know, militant smoking holdout of the kind of art world. Who's the militant smoking holdout of the rock world? I don't know.
There is one.
Keith stopped.
Keith stopped. Liam Gallagher stopped, I think.
Ronnie stopped.
Ronnie Wood stopped. Noel Gallagher stopped. I mean, these people, it was compulsory.
Has Joni Mitchell stopped?
That Joni Mitchell would be the last bastion. Joni Mitchell always kept going. And I was amazed, really, because somehow she just did have affected her voice, but she was an incredibly enthusiastic smoker, wasn't she? And I think still is.
Could well be, but you just don't see it, you know, generally. It seems to hang on more outside the coffee shops near where I live than it hangs on amongst the rock fraternity.
Because if you want to smoke now, you've got to go through such misery, haven't you? Didn't you once interview Emmy Lou Harris and she had to go outside?
I'll tell you this. I did. I interviewed Emmy Lou Harris and, this must have been in the current century. And she was staying at the Langham, very splendid hotel opposite the BBC in Brook and Portland Place.
Yeah.
And saying it's a fabulous suite, which must have cost an A and an L. And at the end of the interview, she was going to go downstairs to have a cigarette. And presumably the only place, it didn't matter what kind of rock star, film star, personality you are, if you're staying in a luxury hotel nowadays and you want to have a smoke, you presumably have to go down by the goods entrance and rub shoulders with the washers up and relieve security men or whatever, who are all out there huddling, having a cig. And I'm saying, if you're a star, that's going to test your devotion to cigarettes.
It really is.
I would have thought, because they're not used to being with normal people.
Because you can't just lean out the balcony and have a fag anymore, can you? I don't think you're even allowed to do that.
No. Anyway, let us know if you've seen any of your rock favourites still smoking. We want to know. We want to keep track.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So correspondence from the Mastiff has been flowing in, Mark. I was particularly taken by this from Gareth, all the way from New Zealand. He thinks he's possibly the only former UK magazine fanatic in New Zealand. We happen to know that's not the case, don't we?
We've got some pals in New Zealand.
But anyway, he's particularly taken by the fact we were mentioning various things we were mentioning last week, members with zany names, and he pointed out the Vernon Dudley Bohay Noel of the Bonzo Dog Band. That was actually his real name.
It was his real name, actually. You're absolutely right. I think there we were kind of applauding the great man without making that point, that he didn't make it up. What a great name. If you're born Vernon Dudley Bohay Noel, you can only really got one, really got one passage in life ahead of you, which is to join the Bonzo Dog Doodle Band.
Just hang about and wait for the Bonzo Dog Band to form. But I was also taken by Gareth. Remembers we were talking about it's now safe if you worked in the magazine business, it's now safe to have a go at W.H. Smith's because they're so kind of reduced. And he points out that when he left London for New Zealand in the mid 90s, he says the W.H. Smith at Waterloo Station was a brightly lit cathedral to the magazine with flying buttresses of OK and Hello, curly cues of women's weeklies, deep piles of computer and music and photography of figure and fashion, and, well, everything mainstream and quite a bit that wasn't. It was vast. I forget the exact figures, he says, but for many magazines, that single shop could account for a third of all London sales. It probably could.
Yeah, I think it would have done.
And in some cases, 20% of all national sales. It was the only bookstore where I would go and watch the display of the titles I worked on and reasonably expect to see somebody buy a copy. I've done that.
You didn't have to. I used to do that, hang around waiting by the piles of Q magazine, saying, please, somebody help put my kids through college. I know.
But anyway, he says that the last time he visited Waterloo Station in 2017, I thought I might go and pay my respects, perhaps purchase a magazine or two. Carry on, Mark. Carry on.
Yeah, he said it took me some time to locate a W.H. Smith. It was a dark, low-ceilinged little shop stuffed with crisps and carbonated beverages. I thought there would have to be another one somewhere on the concourse, so I walked round it twice, nothing. So I returned to the WHS and I looked beyond the sweets and sandwiches, and there, in a dingy little corner, was a rack of magazines that would have disgraced a corner shop newsagent back in the day, and I knew the world changed. But I didn't think it had changed that much. On my way out of the station, someone thrust a free copy of The Enemy at me. Sick transit, etc., etc. Keep on mentioning the cow gum, Tippex, and spray mount. Evil stuff. Evocative to those of us who say. Because we were talking about all that, weren't we? I think in the podcast about Tony Fletcher, wasn't it?
Yes, we were. Yeah,
where he was talking about copies of Jamming that were all stapled together, his fanzine stapled together on his bedroom floor. Fantastic.
It's lovely to hear from you, Gareth.
That's a great letter.
Very, very well evoked that,
it was,
that
brilliant.
Era. What else have we got in terms of... Jeffrey. Jeffrey is asking, I think we previously dilated on the subject of the distinction between progressive and prog rock, which, if I could just recap, I think progressive was a term applied in the late 60s, early 70s, and was more or less interchangeable with the term underground as a way of describing the new form of rock. And then prog rock was a later term, late 70s, early 80s, when by which stage it was quite clear, you know, that prog rock was musicians wearing T-shirts with bell sleeves, you know, and playing twin neck guitars and pieces of work that had many sections.
Progressive was a kind of musical exploration, wasn't it? So Soft Machine were a progressive band because they were kind of working out new adventures in jazz, and Cream with blues, and Pink Floyd with kind of psychedelic pop. And prog was more about sort of technical noodling, do you think?
Yes.
Prowess, showboating, musical showboating, was it? You know, I was classically trained, that kind of thing.
Anyway, Jeffrey wants to know, is there a difference between heavy rock and heavy metal?
That's good.
Ah, it is good.
That's good.
Heavy rock, I don't know. You would have said, well, Led Zeppelin, are Led Zeppelin heavy metal? I
thought heavy rock was kind of budgy and Brewer's Droop with a kind of lump and boogie.
Well, I don't know.
Heavy metal is something different. It's Black Sabbath, it's riffs, and it's
more
it's
industrial.
Fantasy.
It's more male. I'm going to venture a further point. I don't think heavy metal's sexy.
Oh, right. Okay.
I don't think it is. I think that's part of its appeal. It's not. You know what I mean?
Okay, that's very interesting. So David Coverdale, would he ever have been to heavy metal?
It's probably more heavy rock, actually.
Yeah.
I think the further you go towards the metal end of it, the less sexy it is. That's all. I don't have a definitive answer to your question, Jeffrey. Mark Lawrence, TV football pundit. He says the Doors seem only grudgingly included in the 60s pantheon of true rock legends. Morrison was hardly the only bad boy amongst them, but I think the Val Kilmer movie killed the love and affection. Do we agree? Yes. Yeah, I agree.
I think we do. It's funny because I love the Doors. It's interesting. It's the opposite for me.
You can't love the Doors. You can't.
I don't love them, but I like the music enormously. But the problem is Jim Morrison.
Yes.
The more you discover about Jim Morrison, the more obnoxious, pretentious, narcissistic, and unpleasant he appeared to be. And that's become a complete obstacle now. I can't divorce who I think he is and the stuff I found out. He used to pretend that his father didn't exist, didn't he? That he didn't have any parents. Because his father was actually the naval officer.
An admiral
running the, I think, an aircraft carrier that was actually sending planes in to bomb Vietnam. So he kept very quiet about this. He was the most deviant, horrible, grotesque character. And I think it's very hard to like the group. I feel the opposite way about Foo Fighters. Foo Fighters music, I don't really, you know, it's not really for me. I can understand why they're so good. But Dave Grohl is so lovable, so adorable. And I will always make a point of listening to or watching anything that he's on. He was on Graham Norton the other night. It's just so winning and companionable and charming. And that kind of affects your view of it, you know.
Definitely.
I love the Foo Fighters, the concept of them, because of him. And I kind of, you know, I used to love the Doors when I was a kid, but I've just find him a total obstacle there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So there it is. The answer to that surely is no, the Doors.
I've just noticed Alex has joined us.
Hi, guys.
Hello, Alex.
How are you?
I'm in the corner.
He's keeping very quiet in the corner.
Yeah. Alex is on sea cruise, people. You know this.
Speak when I'm spoken to.
Yeah, yeah.
How's things on your cruise, Alex?
Going very well, yeah. We're in Barcelona today. It's cloudy. That's not so good. But the shows are going well. They're well attended. The band's good. I'm having two dinners a night. Yeah, I'm pretty happy.
It's not a bad life, is it?
It's not a bad life at all.
I thought of a new thing that your Beatles group ought to do in your downtime. And I tell you what, I had an epiphany on Friday afternoon, because I've heard bits of this before, but I'd never before sat down in my life. I'd never sat down and listened to the whole of the Beatles' Isha demo, as they are so called.
They're fantastic, aren't they?
From 1968. Is that right, Mark? It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're basically the Beatles, you know, Sgt. Pepper 67, Brian Epstein dies, they make Magical Mystery Tour, comes out at Christmas, not very well received. They go off in February, is it, Mark?
February to Rishikesh.
In India, to the Maharishi's retreat, where they take a few guitars with them and clearly spend an awful lot of the time writing songs, which were to make up the White Album.
Well, they claim to have written between 30 and 48 songs. They couldn't remember how many, which is incredible, isn't it? Especially the whole of the White Album, 75% of it.
And anyway, when they come back, which must be kind of, I don't know, spring 1968, they repair to John Lennon's place in Isha, is it?
George's place in Isha.
And they just sit around with acoustic guitars. And I don't know if Ringo's there, is he? But there's somebody occasionally providing percussion in the background. And they just play all those songs that turned up on the White Album. And the Isha demos, which were issued, I've got it because I've got a kind of deluxe edition of the White Album reissue from from a few years ago. One of the CDs is the Isha demos, where you get all those demos, but in the order that the eventual songs were on the album. And it's just astonishing. They're just sitting in a room playing this stuff, which they've only just recently written, and it's still making... They're still amusing each other. They're delighting each other. They're making Faithful laugh. It's really faithful.
Yeah, the versions they actually produce are back in the USSR and all, are incredibly like what they did in those demos. They're just kind of just worked up, aren't they? More elaborate, but I mean, it's the same basic structure.
And the thing that struck me, Alex, was this would have been the greatest MTV Unplugged anybody had ever done.
Ooh,
by a street. I mean, by an absolute country mile. You cannot believe how good they are, how good their harmonies are.
Yeah.
Just the interplay between them is absolutely astonishing. And of course, they were just doing it for a demo. You know, they didn't think anybody was going to hear it but themselves, which probably made it better. It's amazing. So that's what I think you should do, Alex. With your Beatles. Beatles Unplugged set.
Yeah,
it's an idea.
It's a tambourine, it's three stools, it's acoustics.
It is absolutely. And it's a busking set, it's a folk club set, it's a hootenanny set. You go and listen to it. It sounds like these references may not mean much to you, young lad, young fella, me lad, but it sounds like a cross between Bob Dylan and the Band's Basement Tapes and the Beach Boys Party. It's
very
got
good.
That
yeah.
feeling about it. It's just amazing. And that's what you should do.
That's a great idea.
Isn't it?
20%. 20%.
Of all the fortune that you make.
It's amazing that they wrote all those songs in Rishikesh because they've gone out there to meditate, haven't they? They've gone out there to meet the Maharishi. My theory is that they all went off him quite quickly and just thought, actually, do you know what? It's February. We're in India. It's a very sunny holiday. Let's just get the guitars out and write some songs. Because they wrote Bungalow Bill and Oh Blood D and Rocky Raccoon and all these very non-spiritual songs. Why don't we do it in the road? And the idea that all this meditation was going on, that's what they're up to.
They're right, bunking up. The other thing about it is that it's the nearest thing that the Beatles came in their career to going on a conference.
They went
on a conference. They went to a country house, admittedly in India, and they, you know, they didn't have anything to do every day apart from just go for walks and play guitars. It's fantastic. Anyway, that's what you should do. So, have we got any new Patreon supporters, Alex?
Yeah, we do. Got quite a few actually.
Good.
They are Bridget Wyatt.
Hello, Bridget.
Hello, Bridget. Welcome aboard.
David Bruce.
Hello, good David.
Man. Charles Crabtree.
Hello, Charles. Has anybody told you where your cabin is? Let's pretend that people are going on a cruise. How do they welcome people when they're coming on board for a cruise, Alex? You know all about this.
I don't actually, because I sort of go in the other entrance.
You're in the trades. Is there a tradesman's entrance?
Staff entrance, just past the deck tennis.
Just below the waterline.
The quoits.
I tell a lie, because we're actually technically passengers on this cruise. I think something to do with COVID. So we did go in the proper entrance and we're welcomed. I was called Sir and I was told to enjoy my cruise. I neglected to mention I was actually doing 12 cruises in a row. but it was everybody calls you sir and it's very pleasant and asks you to wash your hands.
Okay. All right, carry on. We got any more?
Yes. I've mentioned Charles Crabtree, haven't I?
Yes.
Thomas Gray.
Welcome, sir. Please wash your hands.
Does Thomas Gray get two dinners as well?
He can get two dinners. Deck 15.
Rena. That sounds like a Beatles song.
It does. Diane
Lovely
Aston.
Rena. Sorry, I'm missing that one. Diane
Aston.
Hello, Diane.
Grace M hyphen T.
Grace M hyphen T. Wow. God. Welcome.
Indeed. We also have Paul Wood and Peter Ryan, who are both annual patrons. Annual subscribers get 15% discount, don't forget.
Right. Okay.
And finally, last but certainly not least, Tom Carl, who is an Access All Areas patron.
Oh, well.
You're getting a birthday present.
Okay. And if you want, you know, if you want to know about any more of that stuff, if you go patreon.com, word in your ear, that's where you find out about things, isn't it, Alex?
Indeed it is.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
I was, I put on Twitter an old NME 100 Greatest Records of All Time.
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
Thingy, which we always do whenever these things cross our desks. And somebody else
so
posted,
interesting.
Somebody else posted another one. And somebody else asked a question, which I felt we ought to respond to, Mark, because we can, you know, we have sufficient experience to be able to respond to this question. I can't remember who put it, but the question was, why did, back in the day, magazines and newspapers run these kind of things? Were they popular? Oh, boy, they were popular.
Oh, God, they were popular.
Oh, they were about the most popular thing you can do at a music magazine is to say, here's the 100 greatest
Here's the best records ever, because nobody, obviously, by definition, will agree with you.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's just, I mean, it's funny how it rankles, it niggles. I read that 1976 thing that you reposted, and it annoyed me so much, as they are intended to do. You know, because this is 1976, it's the NME, and I thought it was immensely snobbish, actually, because they didn't, you know, there was virtually no candidates for the kind of recent rock. I don't think David Bowie was in there. I don't think T-Rex was in there. I don't think there was Roxy or Mott the Hoople or Fruit or Led Zeppelin. I don't think any of that. It was mostly soul. So I think it was a little bit of, you know, slight, I mean, fabulous. You know, I Say a Little Prayer, you know, Grapevine, Tracks of My Tears, Midnight Hour, Dock of the Bay. But they'd chosen to ignore tons of the kind of white rock of the time. And I just wondered if that was rock critics just saying, you know, let's just, you know, let's go back to a time when, you know, music was infinitely more substantial than Led Zeppelin or whatever. I don't know. Was it slightly snobbish?
But no, this stuff, it just always works. And also, it's dead easy to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just come up with a list and put it in there. People absolutely adore it. And here we are, as you say yourself, still getting annoyed about this.
No, it's immensely annoyed.
45 years
later. And you knew that 2 years later it'd be completely different. It was all going to be rock critics going, it's The Clash, it's The Pistols, it's television, it's Iggy Pop, you know. Fair enough, but, you know.
I'm looking at a very badly reproduced picture right now on my screen of, I think, one from 1974 from the NME, which somebody's posted.
Oh, I saw that. I hardly read it, actually, but yeah, it's there.
Okay,
it?
Number one, Sergeant Pepper. Number two, Blonde on Blonde. Number three, Pet Sounds. Number four, Revolver. Number five, Highway 61. And now six and seven are Electric Ladyland by Jimi Hendrix, followed by Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix. I'm sorry. Electric Ladyland is not. Surely, isn't it?
Not very good. But it's just...
I
noticed some ringers in there that just would, you know, I think Stand Up by Jethro Tull is in the top 20 or something. You think that's it's a good record, but I mean, the idea that it's in the top 100, that's a Low Spark of High Heel Boys by Traffic. Great.
Is that there?
Yeah, I think that's in there.
My God.
Very interesting, but that just, how long do those survive? But I was amazed by how many of those things were, you know, the Beatles, Stones, Dylan stuff are still in top 100s now, actually. Aren't they? I mean, a large percentage of that is still around, you know.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I'm just looking at further. Sorry, you're going to have to edit this, Alex. Sorry.
No worries.
I'm trying to find other questions. I can't find any. Mark, you were
Beatles at Woodstock. I'm trying to look through the notes here. Somebody talk about the year 1967, how great it was. What new bands would you have on Whistledust? God, I wouldn't be able to answer that. Did your relationship with bands change after you became a journalist?
You're gonna have to cut
overrated, underrated. I don't know really. What else was there?
I've got a couple here. Go on. Yeah, we'll start recording it while we're recording.
Oh, yeah, go on. Do yours.
Philip Laws. This is a good question, and I don't have an answer. It's the second half of the 70s, and established bands have to get with the times. Apart from Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall and the Stones' Miss You, did any other rock acts successfully or even acceptably embrace the disco beat? That's a good question. Ooh, Another Brick in the Wall was deliberately, Bob Ezrin was producing that record, and they went to a disco and to note what people were dancing to. And so Another Brick in the Wall is the requisite number of beats per minute to be a dance tune. And it was a dance tune. People danced to it. The singularly depressing song about children being brainwashed and so forth.
Yes.
Was it kind of, everybody answered it. That's why it was a huge number one hit for months. And quite right, Miss You by the Rolling Stones is, you know.
Yeah, that's it, disco.
That was a genuine kind
it's
of
it's got
disco
that galloping hit. Octave bass line, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you can't include Blondie in this because Blondie were kind of, although they were a kind of rock band and a pop band, but they then produced some fantastic disco records. That was at the time of disco, and they were kind of at the forefront of promoting and developing disco, really, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very good question. Jamie Bowman also, interestingly, sends a picture of a load of CDs he just bought in a charity shop. And they got things like The Who, Odds and Sods, and it's got Led Zeppelin Presents. And he got all these for £1.50. He's pointing out.
What, for the whole lot?
Whether the whole lot or individually, I would have thought he got a bargain. You know what I mean? If you get £1, it's pay £1.50 for a copy of The Who's Odds and Sods or Led Zeppelin's Presents. I would have thought that's a really good deal.
It is.
And, man. You know, I still insist. I've said it till I'm blue in the mouth.
Yeah.
The CD will come back.
Yeah.
It just will. And this stuff is being passed over right now, just in the same way that vinyl was passed over 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
Or longer ago than that, I suppose. And there'll be some kind of revival of it, I guarantee. So we should also note the passing of Alan Lancaster, bass player of The Status Quo, who was one of the founding members from, you know, back in the 60s through Pitchers and Matchstick Men and all that, and then the kind of reinvention of as a boogeyman in the 70s. And then he departed these shores.
Went to live in Australia, didn't he?
Went to live in Australia, married in Australia.
Which is where he was living, I think, at the time of Live Aid. They brought him back for Live Aid. And then I think went off and started making Status Quo records without him, without telling him that he wasn't involved. And that was it, really.
They thought he was far enough away.
I always thought Status Quo, I always thought the Spinal Tap story was based slightly on Status Quo, don't you think? Because if you remember that these guys were, they were the Scorpions, then they were the Spectres. Yeah. Then they were Traffic, then they were Traffic Jam, then they were The Status Quo, then they were Status Quo, and they had pictures of Max Stalk Men. And constantly trying to kind of hitch their wagon to the prevailing trade winds. Then they had a single after that called Black Veils of Melancholy, I think.
They
did. Absolutely nothing. And then suddenly they just went for the Carnaby Street finery in the back and Buffons, you know, and it was... And it was the boogie. And, you know, Spinal Tap was the originals, wasn't it? The new originals, Thamesman. Thamesman had a song called Listen to the Flower People. and then made their suddenly saw the which way the wind was blowing and went for Spinal Tap. Amazing. So they were constantly just trying to get it right and just missing the boat. And it just all came into focus. Massive change. Well, you saw it a few times, didn't you?
I saw the Quo at what I like to think was their height in the 70s.
Yeah.
So I'm certainly a couple of times at Wembley and at Hammersmith.
Yeah.
And they were one of the greatest bands I've ever seen in my life.
Fantastic.
They had.
Why was that?
They had
See, a lot of people wouldn't expect to hear Dave Hepworth saying that.
I'm sorry. They worked a very narrow scene, admittedly. But what they did unbelievably well.
Yeah.
And anybody who says that Status Quo were kind of boogie dunderheads, go and try and make that noise yourself. Go on, have a go.
Well,
because I've heard a million people try and none of them can do it because they just swung Status Quo at their best in a way that no bugger else does.
Yeah.
You know, and...
And they couldn't make that noise again quite without Alan Lancaster, could they? Because didn't they reformed, didn't they, in 2014?
Well, that was the great... I always think the story of Status Quo is Francis Rossi is just a kind of odd, restless soul for some reason. He's always... I think he's a stirrer. I think he sends people away, you know. And he fell out with Alan Lancaster. He fell out with John Coughlan, the drummer, who claimed that they want to replace it with the drum machine, which I can't believe they did at all. And they got in musicians who were probably better, but they no longer sounded like Status Quo. That's my point.
Yeah,
it didn't sound like Status Quo again until 2012 when they reformed for that Alan G. Parker film, Hello Quo, or whatever it's called.
Great film. Great documentaries about them.
And they appear in a Shepperton, I think it is, somewhere like that. And they're all blokes in their 60s, looking slightly suspicious of each other. And there are still clearly grudges going on in this group. And Alan Lancaster is quite infirm. But they get up and they play In My Chair. And it's
a lovely old blues tune, isn't it? Yeah.
It's just magical because you think that band went away in the mid-80s and here it is back.
Yeah.
And it's only back because those four guys are back together. You can't do it any other way. And I think they're a remarkable group, Status Quo, at their best. I don't particularly care for the psychedelic stuff. I don't care for the later stuff, but the 70s stuff, you know, all that stuff. Pile Driver.
And as you were saying, you said you spent a lot of the time just watching the audience. And you see them at Wembley or something. You see how an amazing sight it was. Just a mass of people all identically dressed.
All dressed.
Doing the same thing. Yeah, yeah.
They weren't even looking at the stage most of the time. Yeah, you know, they were just heads down, swaying from side to side because it was just a wonderful, great communal feeling. They're remarkable. So,
we should mention Barry Ryan.
We should.
Barry Ryan made two or three great records, and his mum, Marion Ryan, the Marilyn Monroe of popular song. I didn't know that. I was just looking at some stuff about
her. She was well known. She was always on the telly when I was a kid.
She was on the Spot the Tune, wasn't she? Various kind of early 60s programs or whatever.
She was glamorous as British kind of female musical stars went at the time. You know, she wasn't Ruby Murray. She was something a little bit brassy about her. And anyway, she married and had twins, and then as they grew, they became a showbiz story because they were cute young guys in the '60s. You know, they kind of looked like junior Beatles, and then they appeared as Paul and Barry Ryan, and they had a hit or two.
And the Barry Ryan at the time of Eloise, which was written by Paul, actually, wasn't it? He did a solo single, and he just sums up the '60s so perfectly. I think he's got that, the kind of billowing sleeves, the kind of just before psychedelia is about to tip into kind of the hippie era. And he looks like a kind of Austin Powers character. And he went on to be a photographer and working for Zoom magazine, things. And I just can see him now as being an absolute archetype, like kind of David Hemmings in Blow Up, you know.
Yeah.
More sixties, that kind of Paul McCartney, slightly back-combed haircut, and just a fantastic.
But Eloise is a great, great record, you know, that he did and that Paul Ryan wrote and produced, I think.
And the Damned had a hit.
The Damned did it.
I know.
Many
There you
later.
Go.
It's still a fantastic, fantastic record.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
So, Mark, you went to a gig.
I went to a gig last night, and double nostalgia because it was the nostalgia of hearing Scritti Politti, who it was, playing their record from 1985, nostalgic enough in itself, but also the nostalgia of actually being at a gig. I mean, you went to see Spurs the other day, so you've been in a crowd. Not me. I've not been in a crowd for a long time. It's so extraordinary to be among 1,700 people. Drinking and dancing and heckling and whooping and, you know, all those things again. Extraordinary. You have to show a vax certificate to get in. No masks. You know, otherwise, everything back to normal. And great to see Scritti Politti too, because he had this long period of not playing. He got stage fright, didn't he? Panic attacks, etc. So he's been slowly coaxed back into live performance, mostly by our old podcast pal, Rodri Marsden. Absolutely. Rodri Marsden's the keyboard player. And I talked to him afterwards about, you know, how he did it. This is really interesting because, you know, there are certain bands where you can just get two guitars, bass and drums and go out and play the songs again. But Scritti Politti is entirely about the texture of those keyboard sounds and synthesizer sounds. It's about the electronic percussion. It's about those details. Do you know what I mean? Those little kind of... he had to go back and reconstruct those entire records by listening to them in great detail and working out how you could reproduce that sound and then building a sound bed for each song, which had the percussion in, some of the percussion and all the bass lines. And then the rest of the group, you know, the two guitars and him playing keyboards and the drummer kind of fill in over the top. And I just thought, what an unbelievably complicated thing. 17 songs that you've got to have ready to hit a button. And that's the basic sound bed that you're adding to. And it sounded perfect. It sounded absolutely brilliant. But Green's voice still terrific.
We touched upon this, I think, with Rodri when he did the podcast.
Yeah. Because
Rodri is a wonderful musician.
He's incredible, isn't he?
But also he regards himself as being very fortunate to be kind of in the service of Green, doesn't he? He regards himself as, you know, my mission is to bring Green to the world.
Well, it's a
by facilitating all that.
Yeah, it's a perfect relationship because he's of the age, as most of the people in the audience were. You know, Roger's exactly 50 on his 50th birthday a couple of days ago. So those are the kind of people who were teenagers when those records came out and really connected with them. So he's a huge Skritti Politti fan. So he's just never gone over how lucky he is, as you say, to be working with Green and trying to get these things back out into the public. And Green, as is immensely grateful that without Rodri, he would never have
wouldn't
done
do
this.
It. Rodri's absolutely
the guy who Rodri's box of tricks, his keyboards, effectively is Skritti Politti, with Green adding a vocal and a guitar. Do you know what I mean? And the rest of them chipping in, but all of that has been programmed by Rodri, and he's made it possible. They're about to go out and play some support slots on the OMD tour in November. I think that's amazing. They've gone from absolutely nothing. I mean, I remember going to Rodri's 40th birthday party 10 years ago, and Green very shyly got up and played a couple of little acoustic tracks on stage in a pub with him. And that was the first time anyone had seen him on stage for ages. And now there he is, do you know what I mean? Doing his own tour and about to go out and play these vast 15,000-seater arenas supporting OMD. So it's all just lifting off, and it couldn't be more wonderful. It's fantastic.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.